Hello, and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular issue. And this is part two of my interview with Maureen O'Grady. Enjoy. So in this episode, we're looking at an issue of Rave magazine published in the first week of September 1965. But what else was happening this week? On 3rd of September, a Rolling Stones gig at the Adelphi Theatre, Dublin, is halted after just 12 minutes due to a massive riot. And the Who aren't having much fun either after their tour van is vandalised and thousands of pounds worth of equipment is pinched. The crime took place while the band were in Battersea Dogs Home buying a guide dog. Guard dog, sorry. bit of difference. On the 6th of September, India invades West Pakistan, beginning the Indo-Pakistan War, while the following day China announces that it will reinforce its troops on the Indian border. Meanwhile, the following week, over 400 young men respond to a small ad in Daily Variety and Hollywood Reporter, looking for three members to form the world's first manufacturer band with the already cast Davy Jones. Hey, hey. In the UK singles charts, Sonny and Cher hold the number one spot with I Got You, Babe, while the Beatles top the album chart with Help. And in the US, the Billboard charts, Beatles' Help is at top of the singles, and the number one album is the Rolling Stones with Out of Our Heads. But Maureen, what was on telly on Wednesday, the 1st of September, 1965? So following play school at 1:30, we have Medicine Today, quote, a programme for doctors. At 6:40pm, the evening starts with It's My Opinion. People of Worthing air their views for spontaneous comment by Mary Bray, Alan Melville, Malcolm Muggeridge.
Good God, yes.
Under the auspices of Chairman John Johnston. At 5 to 8, and I had no idea this was on back then, Points of View.
Yeah.
At this time, yes. Hosted by Robert Robinson. And not for the nervous, at 9:25pm, we have the Wednesday Thriller. This week it's The Imposter, starring Catherine Lacey as Miss Chaffercoat, Daphne Anderson as Miss Laverne, and playing Archie, we have an early role for Trevor Bannister, later Mr. Lucas in Are You Being Served? And the evening's viewing ends at 11:25 with the weather and clothes down, so go to bed. There is no more. Yeah, Rave magazine. Yeah, let's go in. It's September 1965. The Stones are about to fly to RCA Studios, Hollywood in LA, to record the follow-up to the hugely successful Satisfaction, Get Off My Cloud, which will also be another global number one. And they're also about to embark on their fourth European tour. And by the end of this month, they'll also have released their third UK album, Out of Our Heads, different to the US version. So, yeah, here we see Keith and Mick on a, is it a croquet lawn or a golf course?
Well, they've got, I think it was a croquet lawn, but they've actually got golf clubs. Oh, don't forget, we are up in Scotland. This is on the lawn of the Glen Eagles Hotel, which is rather fancy. Yeah, we joined them on tour. First of all, how I got the job on Rave was working at Boyfriend, right from the word go. I said, first main group I got involved with, probably the first one of the first people I interviewed, as the Beatles. Their PR man at the time was Andrew Luke Oldham, who was hired by Brian Epstein and emanated him by wearing the three-piece suit. You know, he was really, although he was always quite smart, he did suddenly look and dressed like Brian Epstein. Yeah. Anyway, not long after, he quickly saw what was happening, I think, acquired his own group. I previously had known of the Rolling Stones through a very nice man. I can't remember if he was Romanian or Bulgarian, called Giorgio Gomolski. Very lovely, big sort of bear of a man, really lovely man. And he, apparently, not being party to everything, I believe he had a gentleman's agreement with the Stones to look after them musically, whatever. But Andrew came along and got them, you know, signed them up, got a contract. So he became their manager. Giorgio, I remember, was quite upset about that because he thought the boys would stay with him. But Giorgio was one of those people around, you know, socially, saw him. I say at these drinking clubs, you sort of saw people. You never perhaps met them officially, but socially, I met nearly everybody socially, although I may not have interviewed them or had anything to do in that respect. So Andrew came, I remember he came up to the offices. First, he used to come up to the office, Andrew transitioned. First of all, when I remember working as a secretary there, he'd come up with people like Mark Winter, people like that. That was his stock in trade. Then he had this brief thing with the Beatles. He, I'm sure, was the one that brought the Beatles first to the attention officially. I mean, we had the fans writing in, but officially it was Andrew that came in to the office about the Beatles. Then he came in and said, I've got my own group, and it was Rolling Stones. And because, didn't realise at the time, but geographically, of course, Decca was just around the corner to Regent Street.
Yes, yeah.
And they started arriving at lunchtime, hungry, you know, and stealing food. If anyone, it was always lunchtime, pure chance. And they would say, Maureen, your friends are here. And everyone would disappear and leave me there. And they go, have you got anything to eat? And I go, well, I've got a sandwich. You can have a sandwich. Because we used to, it's a very friendly office, a boyfriend, and everyone was about the same age.
Right.
So we all socialised as well. We're all sort of, I would say, sort of late teens, early 20s, everybody, apart from like the editor and the head art guy. But everyone else, all same age, weekends we'd, you know, if I wasn't working, we're going, having to go somewhere. So they started coming up then. That's when I first remember them. And even I remember my father, who I don't know what he was doing in Regent Street, but he was there, obviously spying on me. I obviously still lived at home.
And
said, I saw you with some people today. And I said, really? I said, where? He said, Regent Street. And he said, I don't like the look of them. He said, I don't think, if that's the kind of people you're mixing with, I don't think you should work there. Bit sort of tongue-in-cheek. I said, no, they're very nice, really. No, they're really very nice. And it's not the way they look. They're actually very nice. They actually were nice. But they were a bit sort of like, just scruffy or a bit unkempt. But I don't know if they were already living at Edith Grove at the time, but I think sort of looking after themselves a bit. And Andrew hadn't got the sort of technique yet. Or maybe he didn't want to, of, you know, not like Brian, all polished and haircuts and whatever. They were just totally different. Anyway, again, got on very well with them. They used to come up to the office a lot, saw them around and about socially, some of them. In fact, I saw Brian not long before he died, but I'll say it later. He would take us out socially after work, if he was still there. Andrew would come up and take, it was usually Mick and Brian and Keith were the three. The other two you didn't see much of after sort of hours or not working. And he would sort of take us into places and say, because he'd sort of take a couple of us from the office as well. And I go, are we invited? I was very much, you've got to have a card. Yeah, you can't walk in without an invitation. And he'd go, just follow me. So we were like this sort of, you know, this sort of flow behind him. Andrew would be at the front and he'd knock on the door, whether his party or reception was or whatever. And he'd go, hi, like that, and just walk in. And we'd all find, and everyone would say, don't say anything. We'd just walk in behind him. I mean, they usually Mick and at least one or two of the boys were there as well. So there was there. But there were a few of us, like the, you know, hangers on. Yeah. And Andrew always said, he said, just act as though you should be there more than anyone else in the room. You don't need an invite. Yeah, and no one would dare ask you, why are you here? And that was his sort of, you know, and I thought, it works. I mean, everywhere we went, we always let Andrew go first because he was the presence and we'd all follow him in.
And did you use that advice in other? So
yeah, I did because some, don't forget, sort of on your own and not, you, and, you know, the back of your mind is you're not a fully trained, qualified journalist and you're meeting new people all the time on a daily basis and you're having to talk to them and get them out of their shell when you're actually basically a very shy person. So it was all, in the early days anyway, it's quite an effort, which is why now nobody would faze me, absolutely no one in the world. You know, I've met Prince Charles, as he was when I was working down at the Physic Garden. You know what I mean? No, nobody fazed me. I was chatting to him, whereas everyone was going, oh, Prince Charles. I said, it's only that once you've worked, once you've met people.
Of course.
You know, Beatles, whatever. But anyway, going back to the Rolling Stones, while I was working at Boyfriend, obviously I got on very well with the Stones. One of the rave writers at a reception approached me and said, now, Rave at the time was the lovely monthly glossy, which apart from Boyfriend was great, and it was the biggest selling girly type thing of the time. But the nice glossy one that had not long come out, which everyone loved, was monthly, glossy, colour. You know, it was really nice, shiny paper.
Yeah.
Approached me about would I be interested in going for an interview at Rave magazine. So this was in end of 64. So I said, yeah, like that. So anyway, to cut a long story short, something had happened with the Stones and Rave magazine to the point where either Andrew, doing a Brian Epstein or whatever, said, we will never talk to them again. Actually, now I think about it, it sounds very much like Brian. We will never talk to them again. They'd upset them. So, something, yeah, I can imagine it was something that old scruffy long gits. I can imagine. Anyway, I didn't know this. So I went to see Don Wedge, who was the editor at the time, and he said, would you mind doing a sort of a test thing? So he never let on to me at all. And I said, no, fine. And they said, yeah, if you can do, say, an interview with the Rolling Stones, right? I said, yeah, no problem. Again, like the Beatles, certainly in the early days, yeah, quite totally accessible. I could phone up and say, where are they this week? Yeah, fine, Maureen. Yeah, go along and see them. All these people were quite good in the early days. They did appreciate people that helped them in the early days. 10 years later, Mick had a list of 20, 30-odd people. I remember his PR, Jo Bergman, American lady. She said, oh, I don't know. And I was only freelance at the time, I believe. And I said, any chance of an interview with Mick? And she said, oh, I've got 20, 30 people, and he's only got a day. So I said, okay. So anyway, later on, she came back and said, yeah, Mick said, as you helped him in the early days. And that was years and years later. Anyway, this thing, so I went to see them. It was that weekend, first weekend, for this interview piece I had to write. They were at some sort of festival. I remember they were in a caravan. They were all sitting in a caravan somewhere. It was somewhere round about London. And I was all excited. I went in there. They said, oh, we only saw you recently. I said, oh, no, this is special. It's for a job interview. They want me to write a test piece. And they said, oh, is it for? And I said, Rave magazine. I said, if they like it, they'll give me the job. So Mick said, and he was very like, oh, yeah, I can see what's happened here. And I said, what? He said, we've told them we're never going to speak to them again. And he rattled on about something where they'd been upset about something they wrote. And I went, oh.
Oh, like, no.
Oh. And I thought, oh, well, that's it then, you know. Because they seemed quite adamant. No, I'm not going to talk to them again. So I was like, oh, dear. Anyway, I mean, it was something like, I sort of paraphrased, it was something like, do you really want this job? And I went, yeah, I'd really like to work for Rave magazine. And he went, well, all right then. He said, but you make it very clear, you tell them, like, this is only, like, special favour to you, and this is not for them, but as you want this job very much, like, this is a favour to you. But, you know, we are not happy about this. Rave obviously desperately needed someone who was still friendly, and they obviously asked around or whatever, and my name must have come up. I don't think they saw anybody else at Rave. I was very happy at Boyfriend, but
Rave, you know,
because it was all friends as well. I mean, Maggie and Penny, we were still friends socially, you know, all the time, holidays and whatever together. So it was sort of breaking up that, but we still saw one another. But it was leaving that sort of setup to a place where I didn't know anybody. And I was obviously the lower pecking order, although obviously I had some advantages. I knew I could talk to people they couldn't talk to. But that's how it happened that I got the job at Rave. So they needed someone with an in with the Rolling Stones. That was a big help.
What about friends? I imagine you have very few friends in your kind of work.
Yeah, there aren't many, because lots of the people who try and be your friends, you know, you don't respect, you don't like, you just think they're trying to be your friends just because of who you are. That's all. So you choose your friends very carefully.
With this article on page 5, the headline is Not Enough Stones in Rave, and it says, once again, Rave brings you an exclusive. So many readers pleaded for more Rolling Stones that Rave girl Maureen O'Grady and cameraman Mark Sherratt joined the boys in Scotland, but their special invitation for a 3-day trip They talked to Maureen and posed for Mark to provide these exclusive pages of newest facts and photos. The whole trip was a mad whirl, rushing from Glasgow to Edinburgh, stopping for nothing but flocks of sheep. Police escorts everywhere, and then the boys got trapped by fans on the end of a jetty by the Forth Bridge. So what are your memories of this trip?
The first thing I remember was, even after that limousine ride with Paul McCartney down Bond Street to the Old Vienna for the pricing, was outside of, I'm not sure where we liaised with the Stones, but we were in this convoy approaching Glasgow, and how whatever the colour of the traffic light was, red, green, whatever, this police escort all the way sort of into the town, you know, pavements with loads of people. Like, who is it? Who's coming along? And just to be in this, and I don't remember how fast we were going, but you just were swept into Glasgow. Again, same sort of format as the Beatles, to the theatre first, get set up, and you're there for the afternoon, evening. First time you see your lodgings, whatever they are, is at night. But that's the first thing I remember about it. The second thing was, I find quite amusing. I happen to have got on very well with Mick Jagger's girlfriend, Chrissy Shrimpton, who was a sort of, she did some modelling for us on Rave. And I became quite friendly with her. And she'd take me along to sort of fashion shows and things. And she would always sort of say to me, is he behaving himself and whatever? And of course, to my embarrassment, I mean, Mark, very, very nice chap, Mark Schout, the photographer, we were in a separate car. And we were staying at different places, whatever. And I didn't realise, but Mick had put him in an awkward situation by saying, pretend you can't find anywhere. Because obviously the place they were staying, it was Glen Eagles. Now, as generous as my publications always were, as if you travelled, they weren't going to foot for Mark and I to stay at Glen Eagles. You know, it's just two single rooms, Glen Eagles Hotel. I don't know how much it was, but it was out of our...
Yeah, I bet.
No, they weren't going to pay that. So Mark said to me, because he was the driver, I don't drive. He was the one that would go scouting around, booking like things. No, he said, I've been all around here. There's nothing at all. And this was all sort of done in front of everybody. So Mick said, I've got a suite. You could stay in my suite. Wow. So I said, no, because I thought, no, I always, he was tricky. Mick Jagger was always tricky. I mean, yeah, I was at this time, I was sort of thought, okay, it could be true. And I sort of said, no, that's all right. And then it went on and on. He goes, no, you could stay here. He said, I've got a second room. And I said, and what about Mark? Like, you know, not worry about where's Mark going to stay? No, it was where I was going to stay the night. And I said, no, you would just say, are my trousers tight? And I go, you've got a mirror there. I mean, again, I was on, you get to a level of knowing someone where you just say, you know, why ask me? There's a mirror. Like, you know whether your trousers are tight. It's like, I'm not interested. You look in the mirror, sort of attitude.
Well, he does that on Get Your Yah-Yahs Out, isn't he, where he's going, I think I bust a button on my trousers. I hope they don't fall down. You wouldn't want my trousers to fall down now, would you?
No, yeah, it seems always slightly sort of provocative. Like, what do you think? Is it a bit tight? Or, you know, is it too much? No, I'm not bothered. Anyway, this went on. And in the end, I said, no, Mark and I said, we'll meet up with you. I said, no, we've obviously got to have a little drive around here and see what else there is, right over. And when we came outside, and I said to Mark, I said, what was that about? He said, no. He said, he said to me, pretend you can't find anywhere. Da, 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 da. And I said, oh, why'd you do that? He said, it was difficult. He said, I didn't like to say no. I said, well, let's sort of say, oh, by chance, we've found somewhere that can put us up. And I said, oh. But Mick was very funny. I mean, as I say, he got me the job there. And like, so anyway, because Chrissy was phoning me up. So that was really difficult. I told him, I said, oh, Chrissy keeps phoning me. She's going, I tried his room last night. I said, you didn't answer. I said, well, I don't know where he was. I said, I don't know where he was. I said, is there anything going on? I said, no, I haven't seen him with anyone. I said, I mean, it's obvious what she was asking. I said, no, I haven't seen him with anyone. And I thought, well, I'm telling the truth. I haven't seen him with anyone. Yeah. Mainly, but I'm not looking, right? No, it's really sort of like not my business. Although I liked her and I thought, no, I'm not upsetting her. I can imagine if you're down in London, you're worried what someone's up to in Scotland. I said, no, it's fine. I said, I've not seen anything. Which was true. But and I thought, that's a bit cheeky. He knew that I knew Chrissy and that we'd gone out to the little thing. She'd say, do you want to come along to this fashion thing? Because she used to do a bit of modelling for us. So, yeah, I knew reasonably well. And we had one another's phone numbers. And I thought, no, that's a bit mean, putting me in that awkward situation. But then the odd, another odd thing with Rave, just to digress a bit on Mick, is that later on Rave, we used to have this thing, the pin-up of the year, Mr. Raveable, I think it was called, where readers would vote on the person they fancied the most. And one night, my cousin at the time happened to be going out with Scott Walker, who was very popular, and we were at the Scotch, sitting at a table drinking. His best friend, who I still find it strange to understand, Jonathan King, sitting there, drinking milk while Scott drinks bourbon. I can't remember what myself and my cousin were drinking, but, yeah, we were all sort of getting quite merry and whatever. And Jonathan Brighton Perky, and he's sort of usually in a Chinese silk jacket, but very sort of, you know, chatty, but totally stone cold sober. And then suddenly we'd be sitting there and suddenly things would start flying over. So like peanuts and then cigarette ends and whatever, all aimed at Scott, I'm not sure, but at a table. And I look across and there's a table about four or five tables away, and it's Mick with Chrissy sitting there, right? And Mick is throwing over all these things.
Superb.
Right? So we're sitting there and I said, you know, first of all, you should, is he really throwing things over? So in the end, it was left obviously to me as the only person that knew all parties involved. And so I went over and I said, hello, you know, what's the matter? And he said, oh, I can see how you get front covers of Rave magazine. And I thought, why would it matter to someone like you? I was absolutely perplexed. Mick Jagger, who, I mean, this must have been, when was Scott around?
65.
60, yeah, got to be 65. The Stones are well established, right? Mick, unfortunately, in these polls, Scott, once he sort of came around, he actually used to win, I think, two or three years in a row. And Mick used to come sort of second or third. It was, and then Paul McCartney, they were the sort of the pretty faces at the time. But it was quite sort of, I thought it was unbelievable. And I went back and I said, he thinks that's how, like, because I'm sitting with you socially, that's why you get the front covers and the whatever. And of course, Scott was so laid back, California, couldn't care. It's totally, oh, yeah, yeah, cinema. I mean, there was no sort of retaliation on his part or anything. He just thought it was quite, you know, strange behaviour, whatever. Wow. And of course, Jonathan was like, oh, well, that's you.
So you're Jonathan, never won.
No. Stones, on the road with the Stones, was a bit different than, say, with the Beatles. I remember the first, I think it was Glasgow we got to first, got to the theatre, and I remember going up the stairs. I think they must have run in first, I think because of the fans, you know. And then if you pulled up sort of a little bit down the road or around the corner, then you could get out and just literally walk in. No one's going to make a fuss with you, but it was always big dramatics, you know. Heavies and whatever, hold back the doors, the fans and whatever. You appear and no one blinks. So I remember going into the theatre literally some minutes later and going up the stairs to the dressing rooms. And about halfway up, a door opens and it's Graham Nash on tour with the Hollies. And we, oh, look, it's Maureen, come in. So I went in there because I'd met them on a riverboat in the middle of 63. When the Hollies were there and gotten very well with Graham Nash. And so, come in. So hey, it was Alan Clark, everyone all in there. Like, you know, it's all great fun. And suddenly, about 5 minutes later, Mick comes rushing in, right, to the Hollies dressing room and said, she's with us. And I said, I'm just saying, so I was like some possession. I said, I don't know, maybe his plans were all going awry. I don't know what plans he had in his mind. I said, I know. I said, I'm just saying hello. Like, what's the deal? And like Graham Nash and Alan Clark, they're all sort of looking around like, whoa, he's got, she's with us. Our dressing room's here. So I said, okay, sorry. I was only saying hello. Because I'm quite meanly, I hadn't actually probably looked or taken in who else was on the tour with them, Well, you know, you're there for a reason, right? That's so I didn't even know. So I was almost as surprised as they were. But a strange sort of...
Yeah.
Very friendly in one way and very helpful and whatever. And then silly little things like... But the thing with Scott, again, it's sort of like... You're not possession. But if you're there to see him, you're there to see him. You don't talk to anyone else or whatever, which I found a strange thing that he didn't have to because he was well-established or whatever.
You don't think of Mick Jagger as insecure, do you?
No, I'm just saying that's like an insecurity.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
So, same with winning the Rave of the Year competition.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Well, I think perhaps the year before it was him. Very interesting thing I found recently, and I don't know where I read it, and I'm sure I haven't made it up. And it may have been deliberate, I don't know, but apparently Andrew Oldham used to, I'd have taunt him or whatever, by saying that Scott Walker had a most beautiful voice. He loved his voice very much. Now, whether that was a wind-up or whatever, I don't know. I mean, Scott did have a beautiful voice. One thing. I even liked his later stuff, the Jacques Brel stuff. I loved his voice, always did. But, yeah, apparently Andrew used to go on about Scott's voice, so maybe that didn't help. Or maybe it was a wind-up. Knowing Andrew, that could have been a bit of Scott Walker. Yeah, I can just see Andrew doing that. Oh, wow, that is so good looking. And what a lovely voice. And Mick sitting there like...
Yeah,
but the insecurity of it.
Action. Secret slimming action by Burley. Figure moulding. Freedom loving. Action that lasts for wash after wash. Every Burley Gaislard step-in has this secret slimming action. Slender, supple, action that lasts for wash after wash. Gaislard step-ins designed for action by Burley.
Tell me about the Christmas party you had, Stones.
Oh, it was a boyfriend. I had to promise. This must have been in 60... Yeah, they served in 63, so it was not long before I left, probably, to go to rave. There was a Christmas party, and as I said, our boss had a thing about the old Vienna, which was a very nice place. He'd hired out the old Vienna for our Christmas party, and it was very, very nice, very slightly, old Vienna, slightly Germanic, but it was all sort of like hanging potted plants of red geraniums and things in the courtyard outside. And I had to promise that they would behave themselves because I think we'd invited Andrew to the Christmas party. So it'd be all sort of like all the sort of the top people, but not the Stones, because it was deemed that their behaviour or presence would be not very good. So Andrew came into the office and said, again, I think about it, very, very Epstein. So how dare you invite me and not, a bit sort of, he was doing the, he didn't quite say my boys, but now I think about it, it was sort of like, no, Mick and, again, they were the sort of social ones, Mick and Keith, they could come along, or otherwise, he was extremely insulted, right? So I said, well, Andrew's very upset, and like the Rolling Stones are Rolling Stones, they're like, and they're more, the Beatles weren't so accessible anymore, so these were our new mega stars who were still, I could still sort of get my hands on, when we needed them, another photo session. So it was all down to me. Maureen, it's up to you, like the behaviour. They must behave themselves. Otherwise, it's all down to me. I had to make sure they behaved themselves. So, again, of course, unfortunately, as I say, they always seem to be hungry or thirsty. So, of course, all the food and the free drink, it didn't take long. Mick and Keith were absolutely sliding down the walls and knocking the geraniums off the wall. And I had to get them outside, and all that was outside were sort of dustbins, and I was sort of sitting them on dustbins and saying, can someone call them a taxi, whatever? And Mick's trying to sort of grab hold of me, and I'm going, stay there. And everyone's going, we told you not to invite them. And I said, I'm sorry. And I thought, oh, God, this could be another sackable offence. And I said to Andrew, and Andrew, of course, but he was more sort of upright and whatever. But in the early days, they were like that. They were sort of anything free drink, anything, they would sort of... But they didn't have much. No. And I think the place I had down the road from here, Edith Grove, they used to sort of delight in telling me how they were growing different fungus on different empty baked bean tins and just letting go. And any dirty shirts, they had a sort of a light well, they'd just throw them out the window. And I think there was a pile of stuff accumulating on the ground floor of old, dirty clothes. Well, they were living there on their own, so...
It's like the young ones.
Yes, it sounded very much like that. But I remember Andrew still was in his, yeah, he was still in his elegant suits. He was still doing business.
Right.
It was only when Andrew, you know, with the Stones, everyone became successful. He had the big chunky sandals, big floppy sweaters. Didn't matter anymore. He could do what he wanted. And he could wear what he wanted. He didn't have to perform in his suit anymore. But Brian, I saw him, it must be a few months, not right before, but a few months before he died, which was very sad. I was coming out of the speakeasy late at night.
Given the Scotch mist.
No, this is how I knew absolutely everybody. I might not have interviewed them, but socially, or I bumped into people. I was just coming out. Again, it must have been late because, I don't know, I just always stayed late. And it was in Margaret Street, the speakeasy, just near Oxford Circus, just down from the BBC, you know, some lower Regent Street. Yeah. And I said, it's a Bentley or Rolls. A chauffeur-driven thing, and out really falls Brian Jones. By this time, he's been outed from the Stones on his own, which was his own choice, not. But, you know, I mean, to be fair, he was a total problem. Keith was a problem, but Brian was a big, big problem. He was really falling down on stage. It really was, I think, got quite serious. So he literally fell out. He had a big floppy hat on. His knee-length boots weren't zipped up, so they were just all the leg pups all hanging on the floor. And he was, and he had a little drawstring dolly bag over his arm, and he was sort of coming out and crossing the road towards the, because I, you know, people sort of looked. You see a big car, you look, and I saw. I said, Brian, I thought everyone's going home. It's closing, you know, shortly. And he was on his own. And I thought, I knew there was nobody in there. He probably knew. So I went. I thought he was drunk at first, but he was quite out of it. I said, hello, Brian. So it's Maureen. He went, hello. I said, Brian, so it's all closing now. I said, there's no one in there. I said, I think everyone's going home now. And he was like, oh, you know, a bit coherent. And I said, I'm going now. So I said to his driver, who was there, why don't you take him home? He said, we've only just come out.
Wow.
So, like, so his whole world. I said, there's no one in there. I said, well, he said, he won't go home. And I said, well, Brian, I'm going to go anywhere. Oh, don't go. And I said, I tell you what. So I got in the car with him and I said to the driver, so we went down Regent Street, down to, I think it was Piccadilly, circled around there, came up, circled up around again, Oxford Circus, and did it two or three times just to like try and take the edge off. And because my friends were still waiting for me on the pavement. So
oh, really?
I said, yeah, because he said, I don't go. And I said, I thought, well, I'm still going to go home. And I just thought I couldn't leave him so abruptly. So I said, all right now. And I said to the driver, I said, where are you going to go now with him? He said, I'm not quite sure. He said, drive around. And I said, you should take him home. He said, no, you won't. We've just come out. He's like, got all, he was. He had his little dolly bag, his hat and his.
Yeah.
So that's the last time I saw him. And that was quite sad.
Out in the street.
Article, it says, the Stones talk a lot about the Who. Musically, they think they're good, and they talk a lot about their pop art image. I think I'll have a jacket made out of a Union Jack like the Who, says Brian. To which Charlie answers, this pop art stuff is a load of old rubbish. What's it all supposed to mean, anyway? All this thing has gone too far. Nobody knows what real pop art is anymore.
Well, I came across the Who. I'd met them a few times. It was at a Rolling after, yeah, it was definitely the Albert Hall, Rolling Stones gig at a hotel where there was a big reception after the gig. And the Who were there. And I had come across them many times and their managers, it was Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp. And I always got on very well for some strange reason with Keith Moon, who seemed to have an attachment to me. And on this occasion, there was a big thing in Street Life that Penny wrote because she was doing a big thing. It was the first issue of Street Life, and she did this incredible thing on all these different stories about the Who. In fact, we had been up to, at the time, Penny had a friend who was very friendly with Pete Townsend, and he had the key to their rehearsal place, which was this great attic in Wardour Street. And he would, it'd be Penny and I and this chap, we would go up there, a couple of times we went up there, and it was this enormous big sort of loft in Wardour Street, sort of late at night, and it was full of every instrument. It's obviously a big rehearsal room, and we'd play the bongos or the instruments up there. But yeah, I didn't know it was there, but it was quite amazing. You saw all this equipment, and we're trying out all the instruments and whatever. And this guy was quite concerned that, you know, if sort of Pete, who likely could turn up, you know, they did flit in and out any time of the day or night. But that was such an amusing thing. But the thing was, with Keith Moon, got on very well with him. The first, I don't know the order of sequence, but I was doing an interview with Keith, who was actually did like the Stones, gone very well with the Stones. So socially, the odd one, you never got the whole group sitting with the whole group. You get, like, say, Mick with Keith Moon, or, you know, dotted around, or someone from one group. Like, Graham Nash was the very, knew him very well socially at all the sort of clubs and whatever. He knew, Eric Burton was the man you saw socially around a lot, and with Mick. Yeah, we'd all sit together, be an odd, you know, like four or five groups, but only one from each group at a table. Or they'd all get up and sing. All these sort of odd people from all different groups all getting up on the little stage there and singing. It was great. Like a little super group.
Yeah.
But this thing with Keith Moon, so I was doing an interview with him, had to get on a train, I think somewhere like Chertsey, where he was living. He was living in a house that was all like pyramids.
Oh, yes.
It was called, was it Lara, Dara, Tara, something?
It was Tara.
It was designed by a film director. Anyway, I arrive, and on this, a colleague, I'll put it that way, Richard Green, the Beast from the NME, and I were travelling down to see Keith Moon at home. So we arrive at the station, and he was going to pick us up at the station. We arrived, there's our sort of limo with the chauffeur for us, and then next to it is a milk float, open-sided. And it's like a little drawing room. There's a wind-up gramophone, an armchair, carpet, you know, wallpaper, everything.
Yes.
And Keith is in a silk dressing gown with a little silk cap, sitting in the armchair in the milk float.
There's a photo of it.
There's a parade. We parade down the road to his house, Tara. And it was quite sort of surreal. And there's Richard Green, who's also a handful anyway. He liked to drink. And there was me. But anyway, we get to this house. We go down the drive. There's a field. I mean, this is in the 60s. On the left, there's a field with llamas. Who had llamas, right?
Keith.
Swimming pool. There's a sunken. I mean, it really was a big. It had to be a Rolls or a Bentley in the pool, floating or half submerged. I can't remember which. So we get out and we go in. And there's this sort of a. I remember we spent the afternoon. It was like a sunken. The living room, it was a big lounge, but there was a sunken sort of pit where all the seating was. A platform ran all the way around the back of the seating. Right. So I remember us dancing all around on this platform. Well, Keith and Richard Green was more of a laid-back drinker. His favourite song at the time was The Girl from New York City, blaring out, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Really. And then he said, come with me. So we went into this room, and there's loads of boxes. Every box had a different colour pill in. Was some blue ones, some pink ones? I said, no, don't touch those. No, I mean, but yeah. And he was really sort of buzzing out. And for a minute, and I said, where's Kim, his wife? And he had a little girl. He said, oh, she's gone to pick up. I thought, I'm not surprised she's out of the way. Totally out of control, but very lovable, but totally out of control. And I just thought he must be to live with. I mean, he was like a real live wire, whatever. You know, every day there seemed to be a time when you sort of heard these people were going that fast as...
Yeah.
You think, oh, well, not another one.
Well, when he lived there, he had a pet fox as well, didn't he?
Wouldn't surprise me.
Used to crap that everywhere.
They're not incontinent. There's a word for it, isn't it? They just don't. They're not regulated.
They're unregulated.
Yes, they're not trained.
Because Kim, he wasn't very nice to her. She ended up with Ian McLagan, didn't she?
Did she? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the faces. Yeah. No, she was very nice. Very nice, sweet. A lot of them were. They were girls. They probably knew like Cynthia. You know, knew them in the early days, and they couldn't. Or didn't, or couldn't, or wouldn't move up. But I think it's very hard to say. But the thing is, it was never going to be permanent, because their lives, your life wasn't changing. You're at home, perhaps with a kid, whatever. Your life wasn't going to change so much. their lives were totally changing. The influences, be it drink, drugs, girls. And also to be fair, I'm not saying that in any strange way, but having been around them and seen absolutely everything that goes on, you are literally having girls throwing themselves at you. Absolutely. And everyone knows that when you're very young, you always, always try to make yourself look older. I wouldn't have known how old these girls were. If someone said they were 16, 17, 18, it was believable. It's the way they dressed and looked and what they... Yeah, and they were throwing themselves at them. I say, not an excuse. What I couldn't understand is that so later on, a lot of the people I worked with or for, I mean, like the Gary Glitters and whatever, who I worked with at Tony's, you know, PR.
Wow.
Again, people throwing themselves at him. I don't understand. Well, let's say there was no sign of anything or any interest in younger. I mean, they were all pretty young anyway. But this to sort of descend to that lower level, I couldn't understand. I mean, they had plenty of girls anyway. But this sort of, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I mean, I came across Rolf Harris when I was looking after a punk group called Splodgeness Abound.
Oh, two points back.
Two little boys. They did Two Little Boys. So I phoned up and got Rolf to do, great man, professional, whatever. And at the time, you know, he did the art thing and he did all the charities and the dog thing. Very nice professional man. Again, no inkling of anything. And who else? And nearly everyone. Jimmy Savile used to phone up Decker all the time. He was friendly with someone that worked there. And his password was, he never announced himself apparently at Switchboard as Jimmy Savile, just tell him it's the doctor, which now I find a bit spooky, you know, the doctor. But all of them, every one of them, I came across on some sort of level, you know, met them or knew them, and never a sign. The only thing about Jimmy Savile was, you know, he used to wear these sort of, you know, track suits and whatever. I'd just say a bit of sleazy character, but nothing more than that. He was just like a bit too old for all the girls he was mixing with. It was just a bit a generation thing. He was a bit old for the game, if you like. All the young pop stars and the young girls, they all seemed to, you know, mesh together. That was fine. Jonathan, again, another one. Jonathan was like the sort of question mark. But everyone was a surprise to some extent. But this Keith Moon thing at the... to digress again and again and again... this was a Rolling Stones reception. I think it was the Kensington Palace Hotel. So I knew him quite well, but he came up. I was standing talking to Penny Valentine, and he came up with a sort of a tea towel over his arm and acting as a waiter and said, "Yes, madam, what would you like?" And I said, it was also very jolly after show, party, whatever. And he was acting as a waiter, you see, and he was putting on this big act. He just loved dressing up and, you know, he had all these outfits and... And anyway, when it came time to leave, he said, "Come on, Raver," because he likes to call it the Raver. Yeah, and he pushed me backwards through the revolving doors that led out into the street. So linked together, I think as I was falling, I must have grabbed hold of him. So we rolled down the concrete steps into the pavement and then into the gutter. And I was left lying there in the road. To which he obviously sprang, he was obviously on something. He sprang up, I remember, leaving me lying there and all my friends coming out going, "Are you all right?" And I said, "I can't move." I had cracked ribs and everything. And no. And again, he'd go, "Bye, Raver." And he was on the road. No, but it was almost a sign of affection. He was always getting hold of my arm and messing around and whatever.
Breaking your hip.
Yeah. No, but again, you know, to live with, probably hell. Yeah, fun and games and a joke, whatever. But no, it's very funny. But the Stones just went off a different direction.
"Our troops could come home tomorrow if the aggressors would go north, go back home, and stay at home. But the defeat of these aggressions is not only essential if Laos and South Vietnam are to remain independent. It is important to the security of Southeast Asia as a whole.
We will not be defeated. We will not grow tired. We will not withdraw, either openly or under the cloak of a meaningless agreement."
There's another bit in this article. It says, "That film, the Stones film venture, is something they are all excited about. To date, the film could be rolling into action in December, January next. It's going to be weird and full of suspense, says Mick. It will surprise you too. I can't say much about the story now, but it's so strange. The sort of thing where everyone dies in the middle is going to be great. Better than anyone will expect from us. Keith and I are writing the songs for it, and we're even lending a hand on the script. This will be something completely new for the boys. They had hoped to start on the film this summer and are quite disappointed that it had to be paused till the end of the year. And this was back behind and in front, which
I have to say, never happened. Do not recall it at all. Was it made? Did it happen?
Well, it was going to be co-directed by Andrew Lew Goldham and Alan Klein.
Famous Alan Klein.
Yeah, and basically the Aftermath album, it was either for this film or another film that never got made after this as well, but the songs on Aftermath would have been on a soundtrack of some sort, or some of them. And it's also said that at the time, the director of Rebel Without the Cause, Nicholas Ray, was going to direct it. But apparently the whole thing fell through because Mick met Ray and didn't like him. So that's it.
That would figure, wouldn't it?
But yeah, it's a nice thought.
Yeah, Mick is a bit of a mischievous thing. I don't know, I saw not long ago quite an incredible documentary on Anita Pallenberg.
Brilliant.
Did you see it?
Yes.
Yeah, and he was a bit of a mischief maker there when he was making a film with her, where he was obviously, well, she started off with Brian. Okay, Brian was always the sad loser in everything because it was his group. He was the one that got booted out. Anita was with him first and then with Keith. It was all a bit matter of fact.
During a holiday together.
Life. Yeah. Although, and I must say, Anita Pallenberg, she lived just on the corner down here. Yeah, just I used to see her where I worked at the Physic Garden. She used to come in and do botanical art lessons at the Physic Garden down the road. Until she died a few years ago. And her son, Marlon, is it? Yes, he used to see him turning up at the house.
He did the documentary, I think, didn't he?
Yes, he was involved. Yeah, he was involved. Because I looked and I thought, I used to see him going in and out of the building. And I thought, of course, Keith was your father. Keith was your father.
Yeah.
Because, he's still going strong, Keith. Well, he's here. As he says, he's glad to be anywhere. That's his famous onstage line, is it? Nice to be here, and it's glad to be anywhere. I think the funniest thing I ever saw was when he fell out of a palm tree. Had no effect on him whatsoever. They say him and cockroaches, if the world comes to an end, it will be cockroaches and Keith Richards, which is very unkind, but I say that in a kindly way. Mm. He's all right. But, yes, I thought he was a bit of a mischief maker then, Mick, with...
Performer.
Poor Anita, yes.
Everything turn. There is a season turn. And there are time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant.
Then we have a double-page spread, Bird's Eye View of the Birds, or Five Birds in the Hand Are Worth a Crazy, unexpected interview with rave writer Dawn James.
Yeah, she was our main freelance. Well, there was Dawn James, there was Keith Olsom. Yeah, we used to have quite a sort of a large group of people, very good photographers on rave. We had Gerard Mankiewicz, once or twice, probably someone like Terry O'Neill. Very sort of odd things, but maybe they were bought in. But so I did sort of meet them socially at what would be the Scotch Club. But where we were in Rave, the first office of Rave was on the corner of Kingsway and directly opposite, across the zebra crossing or whatever there was there at the time, I don't know what it was called, was right in the corner of Kingsway. It was the Ready Steady Go Studios.
Oh, yeah.
So every Friday afternoon, I would come out of Rave, cross the road and down the stairs to the... So it was Vicky Wickham, Kathy McGowan, people like the Birds. I remember the first one I went to when I joined Rave was Beach Boys and Marvin Gaye. So that was the first Ready Steady Go I went to. And then thereafter, obviously, Beatles, Stones, whatever. So that was all quite... You know, you saw people you knew there every week. But that was Friday afternoons. Yeah. Ready, Steady, Go. Just, and that was, you know, everything was so convenient. You would just cross the road, it's over there.
Ready, Steady, Go, because obviously Kathy writes for Rave as well.
Yes.
But what was the deal if someone wanted to go? I mean, yourselves, particularly,
you phone up the press office, who, after the first couple of weeks, and especially as you were across the road.
Yeah.
And as I say, this was the magazine of that sort of age group.
But I love Dawn Jane's writing here. She says, Jim McGuinn is slim with tight lips and hidden eyes. Small square dark specks cheat us from seeing any reflections.
Little square glasses. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, Gene Clark has a rough face and a warm twinkle in his eyes. Dave Cosby seems to dare you not to fall for him. And Chris Hillman looks like a Walker brother. And
yes.
And a tall Brian Jones.
Doesn't he? Yes, I'm looking at it.
Yeah, Mike Clark, reminiscent of so many drummers, seems to have the least soul and the bluest eyes. But that's good writing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, of course, Dave Crosby and I think Gene Clark. Yeah, but these would come in. The first port of call usually was Ready, Steady, Go. Socially, you would know that if someone was on Ready, Steady, Go, probably they would be at the Scotch, if not on the Friday that weekend. I mean, you just knew where everybody was. And the Scotch was incredible. So it's Mason's Yard in Mayfair. But the nice thing about it, which made you feel sort of good, it has one of those little sliding hatches. They'd look at your face to see who you are. Yes. So it wasn't like just automatic walk-in. I mean, they let you in, but it was this sort of like, ah, yes, you can come in.
Because didn't the Beatles have special. Their own table as well, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. There was all this, the high tables at the back. Proby was funny. He lived just not... Actually, a lot of people lived in Chelsea. He lived in Cheltenham Terrace. I remember being around there. He mixed with a strange crowd. He had Kim Fowley, tall Californian type, and another character called Bongo Wolf. This sort of entourage he had, Proby, and a Basset Hound and whatever. And one evening, it was not long after, you know, he split his pants... Which, as a lady, I can tell you, velvet is the most friable material you can have and probably not the best material for a stage suit because once it goes, it's not like cotton. Velvet, it just sort of goes into strands very quickly and easily. So probably not the best material to use. If you're going to stretch and pull and...
Especially the trousers.
Yeah, so I personally still say, and he always said, it wasn't deliberate, but it was. That was his whole...
Yeah.
It was his whole life. He was on a big ballroom tour of the country... And was so quite well accepted in his voice. He was getting hit records. So it would have been very bad timing to sort of, you know, the split pants thing. But that's what happened. And we were a group of us up in his house, up in Cheltenham Terrace there, just off the King's Road. And he was doing this big speech. And it was so funny. He put his hand in his pocket and he pulled out. It was literally some coins and hardly anything, right? And he put it on the mantelpiece and he said... And it, probably true, knowing his manager and agents at the time probably had him on a short leash because all these ballroom dates had been cancelled, right? He had nothing. He said, this is all I've got in the world. And he put it on the mantelpiece. And then I think we all drifted into the kitchen or wherever, into another room. And literally half an hour later, we've all drifted back in the room and all the money had gone. Someone had taken his money. And he's going, he was like, the despair. He's gone, that's all I had. And he, this big gesture, like, everybody, this is all I've got. And he kept, someone had taken it.
Oh, no.
It shows you the rough crowds we were travelling with in those times. They would actually pinch a last, poor man's
PJ
last.
PJ Proby's last few pence.
No, really, this is all I've got. You know, so dramatic and heartfelt. And then he looked, it's gone.
When your pretty eyes are filled with tears and the sounds of this cruel world are ringing in your ears, darling, when the night surrounds you and there's darkness all around you. Baby, baby, don't you worry, I'll be there. And you can run to my loving arms. They'll keep you warm and hold you tight.
On page 24, it's really quite a sad thing. It's Billy Fury. And it's a whole article about how he's no longer what he once was.
Well, he was Liverpool, wasn't he? He was Liverpool. He was
yeah,
the first sort of
Ronald
Liverpool
Witchley.
Boy. Yeah, he was a big thing on from the boyfriend. He was so one of those on the, if you like, the winner date or, you know, pin up, whatever. Very much a boyfriend thing. The Beatles did do a lot of stirring of things, if you like, sort of knocking the
yes.
yeah people down the pecking
previous
order
generation.
Who once were at the top. Yeah, he was a very, very nice man, very quiet, very laid back, had a, his chest wasn't very good. Although, I mean, he went on for quite a while, but very softly spoken. He would appear in the office. I think I'm not saying met him, but I think I was around when he first came up to boyfriend. When I was still a secretary, he came up to the office
yeah.
to be interviewed. But yeah, it was sad, but that's what happened. That's what the Beatles did for good or whatever, you know, a lot of people were pushed down the order. Different style of singing, different kinds of groups just weren't. I mean, even Cliff, you know, these people, they were sort of like, everyone was a bit wary. And lots of groups, they just were a bit worried. But I went to interview the Shadows at the Palladium and they were talking about the Beatles. I mean, again, so well established. And they were, you know, they were at the Palladium. They were sort of talking about the Beatles and, you know, what were they like and whatever. Like, never met them, but sort of like in awe. And you think, well, you're not so bad and you've done very well. But it was like, that's what I think when people thought perhaps the career in music wasn't sort of forever. But again, they, if they wanted to, they could still do a concert or two, right? They could still reform and do things. But it's amazing looking back at the time, even the Beatles, I remember just casual conversations or people, other people asking them, nobody was expecting anything. They would go out 4, 5 years, 6 years. Yeah, if you're lucky, whatever. And the Beatles would say, if they didn't have a song, do you think the Stones would like that one? And, you know, whatever. And they go, who do you think might like it? Again, sort of like little money-making ideas. As though it was like, well, we do what we can for now. Like, it wasn't like thinking ahead 5, 10, 15, 20, whatever. No, it just didn't occur to anyone. Because it was considered your lifespan was probably on your age and your looks and whatever, and your popularity. They saw people come and go, which is true. And there seemed to be a sort of an unwritten sort of age limit. It was where it happened in music, as in films. You know, 1 minute you're the biggest film star in the world, next year someone else comes along.
If I'm just a toy, you're gonna play. If I'm not the girl you're gonna stay with, then don't take all my love. Don't let me give you all my love. Oh, no, no, no. 'Cause I want you to leave a little love in my heart.
It's a great article on page 17, Fame Has Changed Me. It is an interview with 16-year-old Lulu.
Oh, Lulu, yeah, I knew her quite well.
And it's fascinating how she's dealing with fame, because it starts off, she is 16 and looks it. She sings sophisticated songs on television with the air of someone who knows what life is all about. But when you meet her, she bounces and laughs and says comforting things like, oh, I adore your ring, and isn't so-and-so a darling? But there's a really perceptive bit here where she's talking about fame. You know, bear in mind she's 16. She says, it's changed me, she says simply. I have a whole new set of values. I know lots of people who get on in the world and take pride in remaining the same. You hear the cry go up, good old so-and-so, he hasn't changed one bit. Well, by good old so-and-so standards, I should be ashamed, but I'm not. things that were a treat 2 years ago I now take for granted. There are ways of behaving I didn't know about that I now think are proper and normal. And the friends I used to know suddenly seem worlds away from me. When we meet, I'm at a strange disadvantage. I dare not talk about the boys I know because it all sounds as though I'm name-dropping. And if I say what clothes I bought, they'll think I'm swanking. And what else do you talk to old girlfriends about if not boys and clothes? It's a bit scaring knowing you're slipping away from what you were, what your folks are, but it's inevitable. I just thought that was really perceptive for a 16.
Yeah, she was actually very, very nice. I mean, I wasn't much older than her. I think she was 16, did you say? Yeah, she was living down in London with her manager. She'd been brought down. Very much working class background. I don't know quite, when she had the group, Lulu and the Lovers, I know her brother was in the group. I don't know what happened to him or whether he stayed or whether she was totally on her own in London. I can't quite remember. Nice lady she lived with. So she was away from her family. And I can imagine any time she went back to Glasgow, very working class, as I recall. Yeah, I mean, anyone she would have mentioned or anything she was wearing would have been far, far superior or whatever. So how could she mention? I mean, she had a terrible crush on Scott Walker. Because, so when my cousin was going out with her, because she knew us both very, me and my cousin very well. And she was always saying, oh, he's so good looking. I mean, she was a real fan. She actually loved Scott Walker. So she was very much like a young sort of teenage girl in that respect.
Did you tell Mick Jagger that?
Yeah. I think that was Andrew winding him up. Now, the more I think about it, I think Andrew Oldham telling Mick Jagger that Scott has the most wonderful voice and isn't he good looking? Yeah. But yeah, Lulu. And then she, her first sort of proper relationship, I suppose, was with, not Barry, what's his name?
Morris. Yeah.
Who I didn't. Wasn't sort of well known at the time, developed a drink problem. So maybe I think perhaps difficult to be with. But then once a group becomes very established, they are not working every day of the week. They haven't got a job to get up to every day of the week. So a lot of their life is social, sitting around. Yeah, you're too big to be working every day of the week, or yeah, you don't have to knock yourself out anymore. So you've got time on your hands and, you know, sometimes that gets you into bad habits. Yeah, so I felt a bit sorry for that. Didn't work out because she was very, very nice, very friendly, very down to earth. And as I say, it must have been very strange for her at that young age, sort of away from home. And the lady whose name I can't remember was quite sort of, I think she lived in somewhere like St. John's Wood, you know, very nice, looked after like a sort of a substitute sort of mother and agent, manager, everything, looked after her from dawn till dusk. Probably, and a chaperone as well, probably. We did see Lulu out and about, but not in the very early days when she was 16. So, but always very sociable, very likable. You know, everybody loved her, very popular, very nice. And she seems, when I see her anywhere on telly or whatever, no, she doesn't seem to have changed very much. Of course, she had the second marriage and I'm glad she's sort of, you know, she's got her son. So she did have a family, but it doesn't sort of work out for everybody. I suppose probably more hard if you're a female, because a lot of females, it seems to be their husbands are their managers, which I don't always think. Mind you, I don't know what combination would work. Yeah, it's all a bit difficult trying to think. Shirley Bassey and her manager husbands didn't.
Oh, Cilla.
That's the one exception. Bobby, when I first met her, I was meeting her in Kingley Street to go up to the studio. And I remember from a distance, this most awful tomato red hair and emerald green eyeshadow walking towards me. And I thought, what a combination. But great voice, but very, very Liverpool. And she had Bobby with her as he was her roadie at the time. Well, I don't know what the relationship exactly was, but he was her roadie assistant or, you know, looking after her, whatever. And yes, that worked very well because they're very close and she was very much a sort of Liverpool person. When I worked for Tony, he was actually her manager. When I later worked for Tony Barry in the 70s, he was a manager and she would come up to the office a lot. She would have her equity card and exactly opposite was Dickens and Jones, which was quite a nice store at the time. And she would go, Bobby, I'm going over to Dickens and Jones. And she'd go, have you got my card? Could you got a discount? All right. You got a discount.
Right.
I don't know if it was for everything, but certainly for fabrics. And it was obviously a tax discount. Your clothes. Bobby, I'm going over to Dick and Jane get, for her outfits and her costumes that she was having made. What else? Oh, and then diamond merchants would come up to the office because we were just Hanover Street, which is just off Regent Street. Yeah, she'd come up, she'd have diamond merchants. While she was in town, she used our office as her sort of office. And the diamond merchants would come in to show their wares to see if she was going to buy anything. Oh, and then I also, as part of my, it wasn't really part of my job, but it was an awful thing I had to do. She was also breeding Briards, these giant dog, beautiful big dogs. And I had to do all their kennel club forms. And of course, it starts off quite, ordinary writing. And they get small, and when you get to the grand sires and the whatever, down to the great, 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 great mothers, whatever. And I had that job. I thought, these bloody dogs. She used to have quite a few of them. These are lovely dogs, big black dogs. She also used to bring in bags and bags of clothing for Tony, because Tony Barrow used to go home up to Liverpool now and again, and he used to take these clothes and drop them off to Scylla's mother, who would sell them on the market up in Liverpool.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say give them to charity.
No. Her mum used to have a place in a market. I don't know if it was every week or now and again, but and they were very, I'd sort of look in the bag, very nice clothes, bags of clothes, which she wasn't going to wear anymore. Yeah, to be dispatched up to Liverpool to be given to her mother to sell.
Cheeky.
So, it's just, don't forget, she was from, was it called? Apparently it was the worst
place. Oh, the Dingle.
Yeah, the Dingle, yeah.
So she's given the money to her mum.
Well, exactly. And don't forget, a lot of their mums and that were probably very dragging their feet. I remember reading something about John Lennon and Aunt Mimi. Buying her a house because, I don't want to go there. It's like, it was too much. Also, you're pushing people, if you're buying them a better house, you're pushing them somewhere where they don't know anyone.
Yes.
Right?
Well, she ended up in Dorset, didn't she? From
down by the seaside somewhere, wasn't it? Yeah, and I think he only went down there once, twice maybe. So, if she'd been in London, she'd have seen more of him. But no, obviously she wanted somewhere to live and he wanted to buy her a house. But if you go up the ladder, you're going to get somewhere probably bigger and grander, but probably more remote from everyone. And in probably, if you're working class, in a totally different area where you don't know anyone. So a bit like Lulu, she came to London.
Well, that's what.
How often did the family come to visit her? Or
just a few months earlier, she'd been at school, with her mates.
And I think it was. I mean, I might be imagining it. I think she was from like a tenement block or something. I mean, I know from my background, you didn't have, a room each and whatever. No, accommodation, if you were real working class, accommodation was limited. You had everything, but only one of. You didn't have hundreds of anything or expense accounts, whatever. And I think, with Scylla, perhaps, working class backgrounds, which, again, they were, the back of your mind, is it going to last forever? And probably her mother would say, don't throw that away. I'll have that. You're still dealing with a generation who've just come through a war. So giving things away when they've probably had years of nothing or very little. No. And if she could make a few quid out of it, I'm as happy to. Again, it's not you're saying, mum, these are for you. Can you go out and sell them? No, she was saying, give them to me. I want to sell them. Right, so it's not as though you're being sort of like, you can take these, dispose of them. No, that's what they wanted to do. So they were making everyone happy. So, she would have. I'm sure she would have given to charity if nobody wanted them. But her mother was quite happy doing that.
Yeah,
and probably kept her busy. It was a little job to do, something to do. Her daughter Priscilla
White.
Priscilla, no black, no white.
White it was really.
You're getting me confused. No, she was white. Priscilla White.
I think that was Bill Harry. He was writing an article in Merseybeat, and he knew it was a colour, and he said,
Oh, really?
Then he put black by mistake, and she thought, I'll keep it now. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I got into trouble once with Bill and his wife, Virginia. Yes, because Graham Nash always used to make a fuss of me, right? He said, hello, and he's very funny, actually. He said, I remember the first time you came to see us, it was on that boat, right? And I said, so whenever I saw him, like the Scotch or in a club or whatever, and there was somewhere where I walked in, and I say, these people, like so Eric Burden, whatever, they always had tables near the door because they liked to see who was coming in. And they go, hello, son. Because if you went down into the club, you might not see or be aware. So a lot of them like to be on the sort of level where you go in. And Bill saying, Virginia and I are very angry with me because of Graham where he was talking to me or something. And I said, what do you mean? He said, he's got a girlfriend, Rose, up in Manchester. I said,
oh.
I can't help it if someone's friendly to me. I don't. I think his wife, I think she was a girlfriend at the time, but is it Rose? I think he's, Rose was his girlfriend, or maybe it was, you know, fiance, I don't know. But I didn't know. And don't forget, these boys, as I say, they all pretended they were single, and, you know, from John Lennon downwards, they all pretended to be single. And so they treated you as though they were all single, whatever. I said, how would I know? I said, shouldn't you be talking to your friend Graham, yes, who has, yeah, and your friend, they knew Rose very well, you see, that's why.
Oh, okay.
But again, it's like when people get divorced, they blame the other person. No, you blame the one that was actually married. You don't blame the other woman who maybe didn't even know. I always find that a strange thing when people blame the other woman when the man has said, no, I'm getting a divorce, or I'm not married. Or,
yes.
And you aim for the woman who didn't know or wasn't aware of the situation. I said, I didn't know he had a girlfriend. I said, anyway, I said, we don't go out. There's nothing going on. So what? But didn't like the way we're too friendly. Didn't like the way it looked. And I said, well, Graham's the one that always says, oh, I remember the first time I met you on the boat, da, da, da. Yeah, mate, he's a bit like the Paul McCartney of the Hollies. He was at the time. He was a PR. He would go rushing up to you and go, hello. Like I said, right, with the Rolling Stones, went to the theatre. Who came rushing out and pulled me into the dressing room? It was Graham Nash. Like, look who's here. Yeah. And Mick came and said, she's with us. You know, so he was the antidote of the Rolling Stones. Like, Mick could be very friendly, but very grumpy.
There's a girl who lives down the track in a little shack made of timber wood. And her clothes are all hand-me-downs from the folks in town who treat her so good. Though she hasn't got a dime, I'm so proud that she's all mine. 'Cause to me,
oh, it's been lovely. I think because we've gone over 3 hours.
And oh, gosh, have we?
We've barely done half the magazine and we're going to run out of time.
So oh, sorry.
I think we're going to have to call it a day. But okay. Also, I mean, if you want to read this magazine, go to iamtheeggpod.com and you can read through. We've also got stuff. Gosh, there's all sorts.
Yeah, oh, well, just need to say thanks.
King and I, PJ Proby. You've got Kenny Everett and Dave Cash, one of the reporters, goes around to their
flat.
Jim
Pitney, I met. He was. Of course, there was a strange connection with the Stones, wasn't there? Andrew was his first PR man.
Yes.
Right? And Marianne became very, she was on tour and got involved with Pitney, to which he was a great guy. All right, he wasn't her type, considering her type was obviously someone more like Mick. But she was very disparaging about him, which I thought was a bit, I think she was just embarrassed that image-wise, Jean Pitney didn't fit her sort of mold. But no, I mean, she did get involved on a tour with Jean Pitney. But he was great. He used to come down. Who's that character he brought down to the Scotch once? Oh, Mort Shuman. Wrote the Elvis stuff.
Yes.
Tall American guy. Yeah. Came down, who'd obviously had too much to drink, because on the first landing, which the Scotch was tartan, and on the first landing was this beautiful suit of armour. And Mort Shuman with Jean Pitney were coming down the stairs, and Mort Shuman saw this suit of armour and this sort of, it was almost like a fight. Mort Shuman and this suit of armour was all over the place in a heap at the bottom. And everyone, the manager was saying, this has never happened before. Like, we've had people who drink and where no one's ever wrestled with a suit of armour before. So that's the nearest I've ever got to Elvis.
Yes.
Oh, well, Proby, actually, funny enough, said, Elvis used to go out with his sister. Well, apparently, and I don't disbelieve it, because at the time, I mean, he was quite open about it. He used to do the demos for Elvis. And he said Elvis used to come round, because, oh, yeah, lovely voice, probably. He's still around, isn't he?
Yes. Highly litigious as well.
Oh, is he?
Depending on where this is going.
No, he said he used to sit up in a tree. He used to sit up in a tree. And Elvis used to come around to see his sister. Because he was a bit, I think he was a bit upset with his success, because he always thought his voice on the demos was as good, and that Elvis maybe have copied a little bit, yeah, here and there and whatever. And he used to sit up in this tree and throw tin cans at Elvis when he came around to see his sister. And I thought, yeah, that just, like, sort of jealousy, a bit like Mick and the peanuts and the cigarette stuff. Yeah. Sort of jealousy, whatever. Glasgow used to have amazing sing-alongs in the Scotch.
Oh, I would love to have gone there.
Oh, no, it's a great place, actually.
There's also other articles in here. I mean, we haven't got time to go through these, really, but you've got the charts, you've got Dodo's Pop Diary.
That was me.
That was you, wasn't it, Andres?
Yeah, it was lots of things.
But there's also articles, I mean, you've got George Harrison interview, PJ Proby, Gene Pitney, David McCallum. It's all in there, so yeah.
David McCallum, I met the other one, Robert Vaughan. That was quite testing for someone like me. This was... Obviously, Robert Vaughan was not your sort of run-of-the-mill pin-up boy actor. Yeah, this was a very... He sounded to me as though he was like a Yale or a very intelligent, and I think he was into politics. You know, this was a different plateau of person, and trying to hold a conversation with him. And he had a friend with him, and just their sort of a side conversations, I thought, oh, I'm out of my league here. It wasn't sort of like, tell me about your... You know, obviously, I was out of Favourite Colours and... all that by then. But you know what I mean? This was a very serious, and I was trying to think of serious questions, and I thought, well, if it's serious, Rave won't be that interested. Do you know what I mean? And I thought, what can I ask him that's sort of light, but he won't look at me and think, oh, God, what have I got here? But I mean, very nice, but he's actually been around for a while anyway. So he was very, yeah, he knew the formalities. I'm here, I've got to do these interviews for Man From U.N.C.L.E., this parade they have to go on, like, I've got to promote this film.
So, I'm going to try again.
Sorry.
Thank you so much. I genuinely loved it. I love things like the Scotch of St. James and all that.
It's pretty closed. I wonder so if I'd much. Still be going there. I tell you what, it was open Monday to Saturday.
Right.
And they suddenly announced they'd be opening Sundays. And I said, no, please. I need a day off. I just loved it. You felt you were missing something. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, you're young, single, and you went there. Every night there was somebody there, either just flown from America or someone just come off tour. And as I said, you've got the most incredible mixture of people up on stage. You'd have Eric Byrne and Keith Moon on drums, and absolutely incredible sort of lineup would suddenly, and you'd look and think, wow, what a little group that would be. You know, they had all played together, all had fun together. But when they said they were opening 7 nights a week, I was like, no, I need a day off.
Yeah. So, Maureen, very briefly...
If we can.
What are your memories of your time at Rave?
Rave, I enjoyed very much. Fortunately, I was there, until 1970. So I was there for a good 6 years. And it was great. I met a lot of people. Oh, the one thing I did partly influence was with Jimi Hendrix, who I got to know through the Animals. They also took me along to the Savoy to meet Dylan. You know, just on a social level, which was, but I knew Eric well. And you go, oh, have you met Bob Dylan? And I said, no, we're going to the Savoy to meet. He's a friend of ours. Do you want to come along? I go, yeah. So, I mean, this is just, so, yeah, it wasn't work. It was just a social thing. And Dylan wasn't quite our thing at the time, but, you know, I met people and I could drop his name in here and there. Hendrix was obviously through Chaz over the years, knew Chaz very well. And again, Penny and I saw Jimmy at the Bag of Nails. Yeah, the first night. We'd all thought, yes. God, he's a bit over the top, you know, a bit sort of worrying. But Chaz invited us around to his house, Jimmy's place in the West End. And we were trying to get him to go because it was running late. But he was playing the Goons. And he kept giggling away. And we
Jimmy Hendrix?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Loved the Goons, which was a surprise. I'd sort of grown out of them. I used to like them, but I'd grown out of them. But someone had sort of rediscovered them. And then, of course, there wasn't a colour thing on Rave, but Chaz was on at me because obviously people did like being on the front cover, whatever. So he would say to me, what about a front cover on Jimmy? Because a lot of people, because I was the sort of, to most people, the sort of face of it, Peter Asher, when he was with James Taylor, he introduced me as the editor. And I go, no, I'm not the editor. But it was like, that, I was the one they thought of as Rave magazine. So Chaz would say to me, what about the front cover? And I go, well, I can ask, and da-da-da. And Jimmy was obviously coming up again, like not like the Beatles, but, yeah, coming up. So I mentioned it, and they went, well, no, this is back at the office, you know, editors, publishers, whatever. Well, no, but we can do. So the session was arranged, and... beautiful session with that red light behind his hair. I kept saying, what about the front cover? And I was told, no, we black people don't go on the front cover because they don't sell magazines.
Yeah.
So they did the hair, that red thing on the back, you know, the light shining through. Mike Bukowski did it, the session, because Jimmy had just bought this ring that he was showing off, this lovely ring.
Because we've talked about this issue, myself and Gail Renard.
Yeah? Yeah, I was at that session. I used to liaise the star with the photographer, usually, right? I was just a middleman, even if it wasn't, there wasn't an interview. And so I said, no, really? And I sort of said to Chaz, so in the end, there was this very strange front cover of Jimmy with a model on the front cover. Do you remember? Yes. Yeah. And I said to Chaz, I said, that is the best we can do. I said, because the back cover they did, that was on the back page, the front cover had to be so Jimmy, make him more acceptable. I don't know, but they said I had to really convince them. I said, no, really? I said, you should be on the front cover. And it was this sort of, I think I'm written, obviously. But no, they don't sell magazines. So it's, and I said, I kept pushing it. And I said to Chaz, I said, yeah, we've got the front cover. I said, it's got to be with the model, which was totally against, I mean, Jimi Hendrix's image.
Yes.
With this posing there with this model girl. And that.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, we got there anyway. But I had to do a lot of pushing. And, well, Chaz was pushing me. And I was pushing the editor, whatever. And I said, really, he is big enough. Like, if you want yes. people to buy it, because of who's on the front cover, he is the man of the moment. Put him on the front cover. Not so we got the back, and later the front cover. But and I said, Chaz, no, it's got to be the model. Like I sort of not quite take it or leave it, but that's the best we can do.
Oh wow!
So, but it just shows you how well thought of it was that people, you know, wanted the front cover. It was considered. And I got telegrams from people. Actually, Graham Nash sent a telegram from New York to say. Thought I'd tell you, rave on the newsstands over here, like in New York, like very well. Like, thought I'd tell you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sort of friendly, you know, so there's nothing going on. But
Maureen, it's been incredible. I'm knackered. Thank you so much for your memories. And please do come on again, because I'd love to hear more.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure. So thanks to Susie Humphrey for the jingles. And to read this issue of Rave, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. But for now, thanks again, Maureen O'Grady.
Not at all. It's been a great pleasure.
I've loved it. Thank you.
Thank you.